which is Larkin against Finance System of Green Bay.
Good morning,
Mr. Stern.
Yes. Can you hear me? I'm hearing some beeps.
Hello?
You're here.
Hello?
Yes, okay. I can hear you.
I'll proceed. May it please the court. A defendant, a debt collector, attempted to collect medical debts from my clients, Jennifer Larkin and Dorian Sandry, and claimed that their debts were owed to Green Bay Radiology. In doing so, defendant mailed letters to my clients, which included materially false statements. Contrary to what FSGB wrote in its letters, my client's doctors do not create, maintain, or use any credit rating.
Mr. Stern, the first question in any case is whether there is a justiciable controversy. And I'm interested in exactly how your client suffered concrete injury.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, directing the analysis really following Spokio. Spokio makes
no. Could counsel? I asked a particular question. Please tell me exactly how your client suffered concrete injury. We can discuss Spokio later.
Okay. The concrete injury was communicating false information to my clients.
Look, communicating false information is what you say the defendants did. I'm interested in your client's injury. Could you please describe concretely the injury suffered?
Yes, the injury suffered is that their right was invaded to their right to receive truthful information from a debt collector was invaded by the debt collector's
I'm going to try this once more. You say that the defendants sent false information which violated the statute. Spokio holds that a violation of a statute is not enough. I'm asking, and this will be the last time I will ask it, for you to describe the concrete injury your client suffered.
In addition to what I've mentioned, I believe that the Spokio is pretty clear that the harm that's required for concrete injury is an invasion of a substantive right. Also,
okay, if that's your line,
you're in trouble. Mr. Stern, you've argued that the letters would cause a consumer to think that she will be without medical care if she fails to pay her bills. I've been wondering, this is Judge Rovner, by the way.
Yes.
I've been wondering what language in those letters references the continuity of medical care at all, let alone threatens the withdrawal of such care.
The letters discuss that the need for payment in order to preserve good credit ratings and a credit record with the doctor's offices, and that by failing to do that, it is going to undermine what they refer to as the faith that the doctor has in the patient. And for certainly with respect to a 12B6 standard, that information would lead a consumer to wonder, if I don't pay, am I going to be continued to be treated by the doctor? Or if I am going to be continued to be treated, is the doctor it's going to affect the doctor's medical judgment with respect to treatment?
You know, the actual language of the letters, I fear that I do not think that that supports a hyperbolic, you know, characterization. The letters indicate that the failure to pay can cause the creditor to lose the faith placed in the debtor, that the creditor is interested in the debtor preserving a good credit rating with them. I mean, to me, those statements recognize the type of natural consequence of unpaid bills. And I would think that an unsophisticated consumer would interpret the letters as merely acknowledging that unpaid bills can shake a person's faith in a debtor's future ability to pay and cause it to rethink their credit worthiness.
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
I think that your characterizations of the letters, I mean, nothing threatens the withdrawal of medical care.
I agree that it's not expressly stated the withdrawal of medical care. However, we are dealing here with not just creditors, we're dealing with medical services. And as we've alleged, that's different than other types of credit and other types of transactions where doctors for a, you know, what amounts to here was a relatively small amounts of debts that usually the doctors don't even know that a bill is outstanding, or there may be an unpaid copay or a deductible of some sort.
You've never been married to doctors, I'm afraid.
I mean, certainly the way we've alleged it in the complaint is that this is not something that Green Bay Radiology does. It does not impact the in any way what they do. They don't maintain a credit rating. They don't maintain a credit record. These are false statements about what this creditor, what Green Bay Radiology and the doctors there do. It's a false statement, and certainly false statements with regard to credit reporting and credit standing and credit rating are the types of things that the court has found as being material violations. That's our position with respect to the way these statements are made. There's no reason for those statements to be in these letters other than to try to induce the consumer to make a payment. And by including them and the fact that they are false misrepresents to the consumer and as to the nature of what in fact their doctor does. And that's the way it's been alleged in the complaint, and those are the facts of the complaint. I had asked for reserving time. I'd like to reserve the rest of the time, if I may, for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Stern. Ms. Klander.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jessica Klander for Finance System of Green Bay. To jump into the threshold question here, which is whether the court has jurisdiction or there's a justiciable injury here, there is not standing in this case because the appellants have not articulated a harm. And the issue here is, just like in Casillas, there's no harm, no foul, which is that these are after-the-fact complaints regarding statements, but there is no allegation of any impact on the response or the rights, of the consumer. And so based on that alone, there is no harm that is at issue to create standing in this case for the appellants. And Casillas really is on point with that, and the analysis that was done that we put in our brief as well as to how the court looked at the issue of standing, which is what occurred that actually created a risk or an actual harm to the consumer's rights or to the actual consumer. And here there is no allegation of that. It is a vague statement that is conclusory without factual support and hasn't been backed up.
Ms. Klander, good morning. This is Judge Rovner. The plaintiffs here allege that the letters contained language that was abusive, deceptive, unfair, debt collection practice, I mean, that's not merely a procedural violation, if true, but a substantive violation that would go to the heart of the interest protected by the FDCPA. Wouldn't such claims, if adequately alleged, support standing?
Thank you.
Should we, you know, be inquire further into the viability of the allegations at the standing stage of inquiry, as opposed to the Rule 12b-6 stage?
Well, Your Honor, the issue is, if you have to look at the complaint for standing and what is alleged. So the allegations are relevant if you have to assume that they're true, and there can't be a rigorous analysis of those allegations. And so it is broader than a 12b-6. But here, there just simply are no allegations other than a legal recitation of conclusion, which is not sufficient to allege standing. There has to be an allegation of what the harm is, a factual allegation supporting the harm, not just a statement that there is harm. Maybe the harm is that they were actually denied medical treatment or something to that effect.
Now, is it your position that the creditor actually maintained a credit rating for patients? Is that your position?
It is. Well, it's a little bit outside the scope of the record, but I would say the appellant's position on what a credit rating is broader than what that term actually means. If you Google, just do a definitional search of credit rating, it's really just what I actually did that in preparation for this, which is, it is that the an estimate of the ability of a person to fulfill their financial commitments based on previous dealings. It's not a credit score. It's not that, those aren't the words that were used. So it's not our position that there is some kind of, they're not a credit bureau. And the fact that the argument by appellants is making that kind of inferential leap is sort of bizarre and idiosyncratic under the cases, but more broadly, just that past dealings will instill a level of comfort as to whether or not they will continue to pay or not pay. So I think that it's more of a common sense approach. There's not really a legal position here. It's a common sense approach as to what the unsophisticated consumer would understand that to mean, and it's precisely what that is. So, you know, it's the standing issue here, again, is the threshold issue. The appellants have not articulated an actual or risk of harm here that would be sufficient to confer standing. But even if there was, there is an issue with the actual claims here, the substantive merit of the claims. And this is not like other letter cases in the FDCPA context. There's no allegation that any of the core requirements of a collection letter that communicate concrete information were somehow inaccurate. No allegations regarding that the services or the debt is valid. No allegation regarding the amount or fees or anything like that about the cost. No allegation about any of the consumer protection disclosures not being included. This is about innocuous statements that don't convey any concrete information, that are basically aspirational. And the inferential leap that appellants are making is too much. It's too wide to be supported under the case law. To go from, you don't want to lose our confidence, or you want to be worthy of the faith put in you by your creditor, to extrapolate that out to you aren't going to get medical treatment is too far of an inferential leap, and is under the Pettit and Zemeckis lines of cases, which is, it is bizarre and idiosyncratic and does not, as a matter of law, state a claim that is valid under the case law or the statute itself. And just as a side note, the letters don't say anything about a doctor or a physician. They say creditor. So to even if the appellant's argument is accepted that the physicians don't know, which I'm not sure is an accurate assumption to make, but even if that's true, we're not talking about the physicians. It's the creditor. And so maybe it's the billing department, maybe it's whatever. But the fact is, the arguments asserted by the appellant are going far beyond the language in the letter. And as a matter of law, we have to look at the letters themselves and the complaint itself. And these particular statements don't convey anything concrete about the debt. And even if accepted, these are all true statements. The point of collection letters is to collect debt. So, of course, the point is to have the consumer pay. A creditor hires a collection agency or retains one in order to collect debt. So, of course, they want the consumer to pay in response to the debt. There's nothing wrong with that proposition in and of itself. The FDC protects against abusive and harassing activities and conduct, not the act of collecting debt itself. So this is supposed to be based on what the statute itself is protecting, and I would say that this goes well beyond what the statute is framed to protect against. Even if there is some kind of technical misstatement, under the Seventh Circuit Hahn case and its progeny, it has to be both false and material. And for the same reasons, really, from what we discussed understanding, there is no material misstatement here because there was no impact on the consumer's response to the debt. There was simply nothing that occurred and nothing that was alleged that occurred as a result of these innocuous statements. The debts weren't paid, they didn't call, they didn't do anything. And so that in and of itself, that failure to allege any different response makes this immaterial and therefore fails under the Hahn and progeny cases. And then finally, I would just say, we discussed some of the puffing cases as well. You know, I would say that this is probably more aspirational than puffing, but the Gruber case that the Seventh Circuit is probably the one that had the statement that was the most like this, which was, we believe you want to pay your just debt. And the court ultimately determined that that was not false as a matter of law. It was not really the issue there was, did that overshadow the 30-day validation right? Because it stated that it was a valid debt by saying just. And basically the court said that's a little too far of an inferential leap for us to make. This is a puffing statement that is not something that triggers a violation under the law. Unless the court has other questions, I will conclude my comments and turn it back to the appellant.
Hearing none, thank you, Ms. Klander. Yeah. Mr. Stern, you have about 7 minutes left, I believe.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. Let me address first the standing issue. I want to point something procedurally as to the standing issue, which is this issue was raised in the district court, was litigated in the district court, and the district court found in favor that there was standing. If this court were to decide that there is an issue as to standing, then I think the appropriate remedy is not to affirm, but rather to reverse and allow us leave to amend in the district court. Which would be something if the district court would have addressed that if the district court found that there were standing problems. So that's more of initially a procedural issue.
And what would you say about your client's interest or your client's injury, I should say, if you were permitted to amend?
Well, we've identified that both of our clients ended up in bankruptcy. That's one of the interests that the
as a consequence
FDCPA was
of
designed to,
these allegedly misleading statements.
In part, the debts in general.
Not the debts in general.
In terms of I come back to, and maybe we're mistaken as to what the law is, but as we understand Spokio, is that Spokio has said that either an invasion of a substantive right, and the court referred to in the majority opinion to slander per se, where there's no, we can't identify an actual damages or common law nature of damages that flow from it, but a slander per se. Justice Thomas's concurrence referred to a trespass where someone could invade the space that someone owns in terms of property, but there's no actual damage. That those are invasions of substantive rights, and we contend that an invasion of substantive rights without the need to allege any other harm is sufficient. When it comes to a procedural violation, then there must be an identification of how the procedural violation placed a material risk of harm to harm that Congress had identified. But we contend that these are not procedural violations. These are substantive violations, the right to receive information and the corresponding duty of a debt collector to provide accurate information. I want to go back to, there's a link that involves the expression about loss of faith. But what we start with is that these letters specifically said that there was a credit rating maintained by the doctor's office. They can refer to them. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
The letters did not say that.
It did say. It's like, for example, the letter said.
It say that the creditor is maintaining a credit rating.
Well, it says that we're interested in you preserving a good credit rating with the doctor's office. To maintain a good credit rating, and I think it necessarily implies that the doctor's office maintains a credit rating. And the same thing with saying is to make a payment in order to clear your credit record implies that the doctor's maintaining some kind of credit records. And our assertion is that doesn't exist. The doctor is not looking at credit ratings, not maintaining a credit record. There may be, an account record or, a billing record of what may be owed on an account and what gets paid by insurance and what gets paid directly by the patient. But those facts, we've alleged that there is no such thing as the a credit rating or credit records that are maintained by the creditor, who is in a doctor's office. And we're not talking about a Bank of America or a Chase Bank. We're talking about a radiology practice. And from those facts, we're saying is when you couple that with saying that you don't want your doctor to lose faith, well, the loss of faith will only matter to the consumer if there's an ongoing relationship. If they're never going to see the doctor again or that practice again, there's no reason to be worried about what the faith is. So being worried about what faith they're going to lose does go to the doctor-patient relationship, whether it's specific to providing any kind of specific treatment or care. We're not saying it goes that specifically, but certainly this on under the 12b6 standard, under Locks, this does not fall into the first category where you can say that this is clearly not in any way false or deceptive. And that's how we look at this, and that's how also we look at the standing issue. And as a result, when we've cited, counsel just cited to the, Pettit case, Pettit versus
Mr. Stern,
Masters,
you have 1 minute remaining. Brief.
Thank you, Your Honor. Where the court specifically said, talked about, was talking about 1692E16, but the court said is that the section is designed to prevent debt collectors from coercing payments from debtors by falsely leading them to believe that the failure to pay the debt will adversely affect the debtor's credit rating and ability to obtain credit. And that's a quote from Pettit, and that's in our principal brief on page 19. So the denial of or the effect on credit records or credit rating is absolutely material. Is a material violation when it's a false statement. And unless there's questions, I have nothing else.
Thank you, Mr. Stern. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.